Welcome back to Dave Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And we have with us someone who's been called the new Butcher of Broadway, although he doesn't particularly like that title, not because it's nasty and not because it's untrue, but just because he wants a title of his own. So we're going to work on that and a bunch of other things with Michael Riedel, whom you'll know as a Broadway columnist for the New York Post. His column appears on Tuesdays and Fridays. And also, you'll see him every Friday night, or I think it's early Saturday morning, on PBS as co-host of the show Theater Talk with Susan Haskins. Well, you would expect that he's witty and sharp and very knowledgeable about Broadway. You might be a little surprised at how nice he can be sometimes, but he does keep
the
night. Don't
ruin my reputation.
Oh, well, yes. Well, Michael, yes, you do have that reputation, and you don't mind it, right, do you?
No, not at all. But first, I must correct something. I know you're a stickler for accuracy, but my column appears on Wednesdays and Fridays, and you managed to say Tuesdays and Fridays. So if you're directing people to the paper on Tuesdays, they're going to be sadly disappointed.
So all these people who wasted 25 cents.
right. No, Wednesday and Friday. You can read me in the Post.
Sorry about that. Wednesdays and Fridays.
So, and as to my reputation, it's been good for me to be mean. I found out early on in my career that the tougher and meaner I was about shows and people on Broadway, the more money my employers paid me. So it was an obvious way to go.
But you're always truthful. I mean, you always source your things. Well, actually, you can't. We're talking about this another time, that you can't usually source a lot of the things that you're saying.
Everything
told me.
Right. Well, everything is sourced in the sense that I don't put things in the paper that are inaccurate. And you go to sources to confirm things or find things out. But I suppose my reputation being such as it is, people don't like to be quoted by name in my column because they don't like their friends and colleagues in the business to think that these people are telling me tales and confiding the secrets of Broadway to me, when in fact, of course, they are. If they didn't, I wouldn't be able to write the kind of columns that I write.
But do you get to play by different rules than, say, some of the other writers in the Post? In other words, they can't just say, or maybe they can, maybe the Post is like that, where a producer told me X, Y, or if they're writing about...
I have a little more freedom of personality, shall we say, because I'm a columnist, and the Post likes its columnists to have a personality, have an individual voice, and that's something that I've developed over the years in the space, in the paper. And I like a sort of a personal approach to covering Broadway. I find it's a place full of colorful and interesting personalities, and I like to kind of draw those personalities out in my column. And it's always fun when I'm sort of having an engagement with them in some way, a debate about something, whether I'm fighting with Barry Weissler over Sweet Charity or having a fight with Rosie O'Donnell or Boy George and Taboo. You know, I like it when they engage me and are willing to either write me letters, which I'll run to the column, or get on the phone with me and we'll banter back and forth, and I'll, you know, print the conversations as they occurred on the phone in the column the next day. I think it just spices it up a little bit and gives character and personality to the industry.
Well, that's the other part of it, is that it is an industry. It's not just a mom-and-pop shop anymore. And when people criticize or go to criticize you for being, quote-unquote, mean, you countered that, hey, this is multi-million dollars we're talking about, a lot of rich people and their toys.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, people, if you want to go see a Broadway show today, it's going to cost you, if you're taking a date, at least $200. Factor in the parking and the dinner and all that, and you're looking at a $375, $400 evening with babysitter and all that kind of stuff. If you take a family, $500, you know, easily. This is a business, and it should be covered as a business. And I'm not of the mind, Seth, as many people who cover the theater are, to write about how wonderful and great it is, because I'm a big fan of the theater, and I've always been in love with the theater. I enjoy the theater, I care about the theater, but I recognize that it should be covered like any other business. And I suppose that distinguishes me somewhat from my colleagues, who I think fundamentally are fans before they're reporters covering the theater.
The way you do what you do, because I know as a theater journalist for a few years, I worked the phones quite a bit and hoped that people would email me or things would come across the transom and go into my lap. You're a little more proactive than that. I mean, your day starts at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon getting up.
Yeah, really.
Pretty much.
This is why I'm in the theater, because I can't get up before 11 usually. Yeah, you know, I know a lot of people in the business, and most of my afternoon, I wouldn't say the whole day because I'm sleeping in the morning, but the afternoon is spent old-fashioned reporting. You get on the phone and you, you know, you call around, you gossip with your friends, and you hear what's going on, and there's a lot of information flying around, and then you kind of weigh it. You think, well, this is really insidery stuff that's interesting to me because I like to know what's going on at some big production company, but it's not really worth putting in the New York Post. But this other piece of information I've stumbled on, yeah, I can turn that into something that has more general interest, would have interest for my readers. But the only way to find that stuff is to just cast a very wide net every day and see what it brings in.
And then do you go to the I bet you don't even go to the theater more than once or twice a week, if that.
I generally confine it to once or twice a week. I find if I go every day, it just wears me down too much. I'm not a critic, so I don't have to have an opinion about every single show. Therefore, I don't have to see every single show. And there's a lot of garbage out there that I just don't think is worth my time or just the effort of getting over there. No, I'm not in the theater all the time. I like to also, you know, to balance out my life a bit by going to the opera, going to the ballet, classical music, or staying home and reading a good novel.
By the way, Michael Regan is straight. Not that any women would be interested in you remotely, but just to
thank you very much, Dave. That's kind of you to say. I have really no defense of that since I'm on the radio and they're not able to judge.
Well, people can judge. They can see you on TV every Friday night. What time is it on PBS?
We're on 12:30 on Channel 13 in New York. Friday nights, technically Saturday morning, and we've just been picked up by CUNY Television, the City University of New York's television station, which I think is Channel 75 here in New York, and we're on that station 5 times a week at various more reasonable hours, 8 o'clock in the evenings, I think, or 2 in the afternoon on a Sunday. I'm not sure what the schedule it is, but you know, go to the Theater Talk website and find out.
So people can get their fill of Regal every single day.
It's all Theater Talk all the time.
But you know, going back to the women part, you've voiced some showgirls. Let's talk about this.
Is that a word that's allowed by the FCC?
Well, if it isn't, you know, we'll hear. What are they going to do? Sue WGBB and make $5?
Well, there you are. Yes. I've been out to that little, literally the radio shack that you work out of there from.
It's actually a shack with a radio in it.
That's right. This is the original radio shack when I walked in there.
But seriously, so Dish.
About my own particular life.
Yeah.
Look at who doesn't like chorus girls? They're attractive and they're fun. And yeah, sure, I've dated a few of them, but
have you ever dated a celeb or someone we'd know?
No, I never have. I can't say that I have.
Okay.
I flirted a few times, and I'm not going to tell you who it was with.
Oh,
but,
come on! Aside from Elaine Stritch.
Well, you know, I actually did have a wonderful date with Elaine not too long ago. I took her out to Swifties on the Upper East Side. We've been threatening to have dinner for a long time. Finally, we both bit the bullet and plunged in.
Oh, my goodness.
And
was she wearing
a
hairnet, or was she actually dressed?
No. She was dressed. She had her insulin with her. She was giving her shots of insulin. She gave me a couple, too, just to sort of enliven the evening. But when I walked her, we had a wonderful time, and Liz Smith came in, and we sat with Liz for a while, and it was sort of it was fun for me, a young reporter myself, to find out Liz Smith's fabulous life and fabulous story and the story she has about being a gossip columnist. Many of which, you know, Elaine lived with her. So it was an enjoyable evening of reminiscing on their part. And I walked Elaine back to the Carlisle where she stays when she's in New York. And I walked up to the elevator, and she looked at me, and she said, "Kid, if I were 50, I'd invite you up."
Oh.
So I was thinking, I love you, but thank God you're not.
Yeah, you were crawling from the elevator shaft at that point.
I was running. But no, I mean...
Hey, look, she dated Brando. And, well, she didn't put out
look
for
at
him,
Elaine.
But...
Elaine is still an attractive woman,
sure.
But in her day, she was a real, real catch.
Yeah. So, and so are you, but you're...
So I don't get my dates at the nursing home. So. There you are.
But you're at the moment single and semi-solo. Are you? Is there a special, you know, regalet in at the moment, or are you just sort of playing the Broadway softball league?
Dave, every new season brings a new crop of musicals and a new crop of chorus girls, so
oh,
I like to keep myself footloose and fancy-free this time of year.
Now, you have also had friendships with men, non-physical friendships, but men that most of us would think would not exactly be the friendliest or nicest folks to hang with. But you've not only had dinner with and had good friendships with, but lived with folks that other people would be like, oh, I can't believe anybody spent more than an hour with them.
Well, who do you have in mind here, Dave?
Well, first of all, let's get started back with just as you're leaving Columbia University and looking for a place to live,
uh-huh.
And...
Yes, well, I mean, Eric Bentley was my landlord right out of school.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful Brecht translator and critic and scholar and a brilliant, brilliant man. Now, he's not someone that anyone would not want to spend time with. He's an absolutely charming, delightful human being. And that was terrific because he was really my... graduate professor, if you will, about the theater. He had a fantastic library in the house, and we'd have dinner two or three times a week, and we'd discuss Shaw and Pirandello and Brecht and Nietzsche and history and Churchill and World War II and the Franco-Prussian War, you name it. And whatever the topic was, I could just walk over to his library and pick up a couple of books on it and read through all of the books about all the things we discussed at dinner.
I learned
about Ibsen and Wagner, all from Eric, all from living in that apartment with him for 2 years. And as I say, it was like going to graduate school with your tutor being one of the most brilliant minds in the theater.
It's true. I mean, I wish I had that because the Franco-Prussian War comes up on this show
every
4 weeks. No matter who I'm talking to, it could be the kosher king or just
right.
There goes that Franco-Prussian War. But and also, you are good close friends with someone else who is the old Butcher of Broadway. Still is, except he's on Bloomberg now. Well, actually, Frank Rich was the quote unquote Butcher.
Yeah, I think we need to straighten up that nickname. That was Frank Rich's nickname, the Butcher of Broadway. I forget who dubbed him that. I think it was one of the English newspapers when Frank was at the height of his powers, the drama critic for the New York Times in the 1980s. And in fact, when Frank left the job, he wrote a rather good essay for the New York Times magazine about his tenure as the drama critic. And the illustration on the front of the magazine was Frank wielding a meat cleaver, wearing a butcher's apron.
That wasn't an illustration. That was actually him with a picture.
No, it was a cartoon, actually.
I'm choking.
Somehow I think it was the New York Observer that christened me the new Butcher of Broadway. Quite frankly, I'd like to have my own nickname and... I'll leave that to your imagination to come up with a zinger.
Nothing I could say on the radio. But, you're right, it was Frank Rich. So the person I was thinking of was John Simon. Now, what would they call him? Because he's considered, even though it may not even be true.
Dracula.
The worst of the worst, the most mean, nasty, personally vicious attacking of all the critics, when he wants to be.
Yeah.
Did he ever have any claim of that sort?
No, the joke about John always was he's Serbian, so they used to call him Acerbic. That was the little pun.
Oh, that's pushing. It's not as good as Butcher.
I don't think John ever... Well, David Mamet called both John and Frank, he called them the syphilis and gonorrhea of the American theater once. That was sort of funny.
Wow. Well, I'm trying to be called the AIDS. I'm working on being the AIDS American theater.
Well, I really have no response to that, Dave. If that's how you feel about yourself, then I think you need some help.
You're just realizing I need some help. But you're good for...
John was a tremendous influence in my life and a close personal friend. I met him when I was editing a magazine called Theater Week, and I'd always admired his writing, his agile mind, his toughness of prose, his great learning, and his great wit. And, I, like many people, I always enjoyed it when he stuck the knife into someone. That's the best critics are good with a knife, and John is among the best.
Did you ever think he went too far in print, or was he always?
No, I always found it amusing. But then again, I have no real human sensitivity, so I wouldn't be I wouldn't be put off by that. But I asked John to write for a magazine I was editing at the time called Theater Week, and he kindly did. And instead of writing what one would have expected from them, some sort of hatchet piece on someone. He wrote actually quite a thoughtful, elegant essay on August Wilson, and that was the first thing of John's that I published. I later sicked him on people like Karen Finley, and he had a field day with them, and that was always fun. But, John, like Eric, is a great mind, great, great knowledge of world literature, a brilliant, brilliant man, and just a lot of fun to be around. And I think, people who don't know him personally, I guess from what he's written, would say he's mean and horrible and awful, but... Yeah, and that's partly the act that we all play. If you're going to be read, you have to be controversial.
Well, even when you were at Theater Week, when you were doing some of the reviews and doing not necessarily nice things, you took the pseudonym. What was it? Was Addison DeWitt?
Richard Sneerwell.
Richard Sneerwell.
Yeah, right. I wrote under the name Richard Sneerwell. I took that from Sheridan's play, School Scandal.
Yeah. What do you think of the current crop of the major daily critics? I can understand if you don't want to say anything about Clive Barnes because he's at your paper.
Well, my feeling, I know all these guys very, right. very well, and most of them are my friends. And I think they're all incredibly smart, funny, interesting people. If I had one criticism of it, I feel it's time for a changing of the blood, changing of the guard. I think these guys, without naming anyone in particular, I think they've all been in the jobs a little bit too long. And I think it would be a healthier thing for the theater if there were younger critics writing about it today. Because once these guys get these jobs, they tend to die in those jobs. And there hasn't been a mixing up of styles and viewpoints that you would get if you had younger writers coming up who would spend a few years in a tour of duty as a drama critic. I remember Shaw himself said you shouldn't be a drama critic for more than 5 years. Indeed, Eric Bentley was only a drama critic for 5 years. They both felt, I think, that if you stayed beyond that, you began to calcify, and your opinions hardened, and you couldn't appreciate sort of new works coming along. And if you look at the list of the guys in the New York Drama Critics Circle, if you looked at it in 1975 and looked at it today, it hasn't changed that much.
Might have the names.
Look at you. I mean, you're trying to scrape by in this business, trying to find a little slot for yourself. Have any of these big jobs opened up that you could ever have gone for in the time you've been in it? No.
Well, they opened up. They didn't hire me, but, I mean, there was obviously the New York Times changed hands.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Brantley's been there 10 years.
Ten years, yeah.
And Linda Weiner, I think, is already like 12 or 15 years.
And the John Simon just got shuffled off New York Magazine after 39 years in the job.
Right.
This is not a growth industry. Theater criticism.
Well, yeah. If you can get your tensor hooks in and hang, then you will. Because what else? Everybody was shocked when Frank Rich said, "You know what? Enough," and went off to do quote-unquote, higher editorial things at the New York Times. And we were like, wait a minute, you've got the best job there. You've got the most important theater critic job in America.
Yeah, but, I think at the time Frank had done it for, almost 15 years, and obviously wanted to try something else, and he seems to have flourished in his new role as an editorial political commentator. But remember the time when Frank left the business in the early 90s, Broadway was in a pretty sorry state. I mean,
Broadway's always in a pretty sorry state.
No, it's not in a sorry state now. There's quite a bit of stuff going on. The last 10 years have been full of all sorts of things. Tremendous changes in the way the industry functions. Rise of corporations, and now indeed the fall of some corporations, like Clear Channel, which seems to be getting out of the business.
Thank God.
But things have changed quite a bit. When Frank was leaving that job in the early 90s, you were really sort of reviewing a lot of second-rate Andrew Lloyd Webber shows at that point. So I don't think he could have foreseen all of the rather exciting changes, good or bad. You can be the judge of that. You can evaluate each show on the merits and each new producer on his or her merits. But the fact is that there was tremendous change in the industry in the 90s. And as a reporter, it was fun to cover. This is Michael Riedel of the New York Post, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
By the way, do you have any thoughts on Jed Bernstein, who is going to be stepping down as head of the League of American Theaters and Producers at the end of this season?
I think it's probably time for Jed to step down. He was brought in at a time when there was a desire to have more things that promoted Broadway and more marketing schemes, and that's Jed's strength. And he came in at a time when the tourism hadn't really spiked the way it has in the last 10 years here. There's a sense that Broadway really needed to kind of show its wares to attract people to see it. That's really not the case now. Tourism has been high for quite a while now, and I don't think you need a marketing division just to market Broadway anymore. I think you need someone who can deal with the pressing labor problems that this industry has, and I don't really think that was ever Jed's strength. So I think he probably stayed on a little bit too long there. He made a lot of enemies because he had sharp elbows, and he was always trying to sort of grab the Tonys away from the American theater wing, and there are always those kind of fights. But it's probably time for him to go, and I think he'll probably reemerge as a producer.
Oh, that would be.
But I think the person who follows him in that job is going to be much more kind of a technocrat, labor relations expert. I think you're going to see the league move away from a lot of the marketing things that they've been doing, not so many Broadway on Broadway concerts and all that sort of stuff. and get back to being a labor negotiating organization, which is what they were always set up to be.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I interviewed Jed when he was literally in the job for about 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed him for a different radio station, and he said two things that he was trying to accomplish fairly quickly, one of which was to go visit all of the 50 states and kind of meet the people who owned and operated the theaters there and really get Broadway moving on the road. And
but what happened in that period of time is that all of those people he was going to go meet and greet, they all wound up selling their theaters to Clear Channel. That's what happened.
Man. And the other one was he wanted to get the ushers out of their doilies. No, I should rephrase that. But he wanted to put them in, like, funky or nicer suits and ties and dresses and stuff, and not the
old
lady.
There are some traditions on Broadway that we should not that should not go by the way.
I want
the little old ladies in their doilies.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was kind of a cool idea. The idea was to bring fresh.
Well, what you don't realize what happened though is he started wearing a doily himself to work. So that's where that went.
That's only after he started poisoning Isabel Stevenson.
That's true.
Let's face it; they now have an extra 2 minutes at the Tonys because they don't have to bring her on.
there was a very funny story told about Isabel Stevenson by Peter Stone and Maury Yeston, the late Peter Stone, mm-hmm. who was a wonderful guy and very funny writer for Broadway. And Peter and Maury were the respective homes watching the Tonys on television, and they were on the phone with each other, having sort of running commentary during the Tony Awards, They had a scene from, I think there was a revival of Kathy Rigby's Peter Pan on Broadway at that point. And they had Kathy Rigby flying around the Tony Awards, and Maury said to Peter, "I can see the wires, I can see the wires." And then Isabel came out to give her speech, and Peter said, "I can see the wires, I can see the wires."
Oh, that's good. That is very good. Hey, what's your favorite play?
That was Peter Stone's humor, and he was a wonderful guy, and a kind of wit and sophistication that Broadway people once had, and sadly I don't think they really do anymore, except you and me, of course.
Oh, of course. And thank you for including me in that.
I know you're struggling out there in wherever the hell you are, in that radio shack there in the middle of Long Island.
Hey, I'm also the co-publisher of Performing Arts and Cyber
Circulation
Magazine.
12.
Well, 14. But hey, I was going to say, what is your favorite play?
Well, it changes from time to time, and I have to say, I recently interviewed Eric Bentley at the New York Public Library about Shaw, so I spent some time rereading most of Shaw's plays, and I came away mightily impressed by Heartbreak House, which was a play that I think I read in college and just frankly was too callow, too naive, too youthful to understand.
That may be it.
And I think, you know, that's a play that you appreciate as you get older. It's a really beautiful play about people in the twilight of their time. And as Eric said, he thinks it's the play that was the closest to Shaw's real view of the world, which one thinks of Shaw as this, you know, sparkling, cynical wit. But in fact, underneath it all was a rather pessimistic view of human nature and where the world was headed at that time. And Heartbreak House is an expression of that view. And it's Chekhovian in its flavor and its themes. And I found that play really quite moving and quite absorbing when I reread it. I'd love to see a fine production of it, but sadly we don't see Shaw done very well in this country.
No, I mean, they keep bringing back the comedies, and they're okay, but they're talky, and they're just not always perfectly cast, and I'm like,
I think you find them talky because they're not well cast here. If you saw some terrific British actors doing it, what seems talky to you would be sparkling. I remember the first Shaw play I ever saw when I was a kid in London in college was You Never Can Tell, and it was acted absolutely magnificently by some superb British stage actors, some of whom are dead now. They were famous in their day, like Michael Holborn and Frank Middlemass. They did long dead, but these guys were they sparkled in this play, and every word, every line of dialogue was funny. Every, you know, sort of tennis match that goes on in Shaw plays between the characters when they take different points of view was really thrilling to listen to and to watch. And it's hard for American actors to pull that off, and so you see a roundabout production of Shaw. And because the acting is not up to the level that you have to have for a Shaw play, it does seem boring and talky.
Yeah, it isn't bad acting. It just doesn't have that, you know, that just not
doesn't
quite
sparkle.
Yeah.
Doesn't sparkle.
Hey, what's your favorite musical?
My favorite musical is My Fair Lady, I think.
No kidding.
Yeah,
I thought it was going to be like Sunday in the Park with George. first act or something like that.
Yeah, I do like the first act of Sunday at Pepper George. I like the first act of Into the Woods. I always thought you could have a pretty satisfying evening of Sondheim if you did the first act of Sunday in the Park with George, and then you did the first act of Into the Woods.
Right.
Maybe it's because I do like Shaw so much that no surprise that I would like My Fair Lady, which of course is based on Pygmalion. But I think that in terms of just the structure of that musical, and you know, the best musicals are very, very, very well crafted. There's not a wrong note, a wrong lyric, an extraneous scene in all of My Fair Lady. And it's just beautifully wrought.
Now you know, I saw you actually. I saw you act at one point many years ago. Just literally, I think you were out of Columbia.
Did you see The Wires?
No, I saw the Schnitzler. You were in a version of Lalonde. What was The Wires?
You know, Isabel Stevenson and Kathy Rigby.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You missed the joke.
My head hit another. I'm sorry, I blew your joke at that point.
Thank you. Well, you're a lousy audience.
Thank you. But you were pretty good. You were playing like a
pretty cult. Good.
You were very good.
Very good? Superb, I believe, is the word that was used by the drama critic of the Barnard Student Union newspaper.
They called you superb? Wow.
In my mind, in my memory they did, but of course I suppose once you check the record, maybe it was lousy, but you know, I've transformed that over the years.
But you never really wanted to go in that direction as of an acting thing.
It never made any sense to me as a career. I mean, God love actors, but it wouldn't be the life I would choose for myself. You have no control or power over your destiny. You know, you exist at the whim of casting directors and directors and producers, and I just couldn't see that was a way of life for me. I wanted a little bit more control and authority and ultimately power, which I've achieved with my perch at the New York Post and on television.
But how long are you planning? You know, we were talking about how long critics should stay critics. How long are you planning to be the New York Post theater news power man?
I leave next week, actually, Dave.
Oh, good, can I have your job.
Big scoop for you to have. I'm out of here next week. I'm going to be traveling the world and covering the UN for another newspaper. No. Get your resume over here.
But could you do it for another 10 years?
No, God, no, I don't think I could. And I think the burnt out factor would do me in. But you know, then again, look at his jobs go. It's fun in. As jobs in newspapers go, it's quite fun. The Post treats me very, very well, and they give me a lot of autonomy, which I value. And so I'm not complaining. The only thing I think that would sort of drive me out of it is that after a while you begin to run out of things to say about the beat you're covering. And I've had 15 years of talking about the theater, and I'm not so sure I've got that much more to say on the subject. And a lot of the shows that present themselves now are not all that interesting to me. And frankly, some of the personalities and characters that made the business lively when I got into it, they're gone, and they've been replaced by rather bland corporate types, and they're just not as much fun to write about.
Well, it could go in cycles. I mean, you...
It's true, you know, and it probably will, and like Frank Rich, I'll pick the time where I think I should be leaving, and somebody else will come along and look at it with fresh eyes and find all sorts of wonderful, exciting things to write about in it that I just wouldn't be able to see because I had been doing it for too long.
But then what would you do? Would you write a novel? What other career would lay ahead for you?
Well, I think if I knew that, I would have left a long time ago.
Wow.
So I don't really know. I mean, I haven't really planned my career thus far, and I don't see any reason why I should start now. I have no desire to write a novel. I'm not a playwright. I'm not a frustrated director or anything like that. I suppose I would like to do more in television. The PBS show is fun, but it's not how a girl can make a living in this town. And
it's how a girl can make a living, maybe not how you can make a living.
That's right. But, you know, if I had more television work that paid, I think that would be something fun and enjoyable to do. But, again, my interests lie in what I suppose you'd snobbishly call high culture, and I would be interested in interviewing people, you know, about the theater, about the ballet, about the opera. I'm not really interested in talking to Brad Pitt about who his latest girlfriend is.
Right. Well, you'd be interested in talking to his latest girlfriend.
Possibly.
Yeah, that would work. Last question for Michael Riegel of the New York Post and of PBS's Theater Talk. What do you do besides the cultural stuff? People may not realize that you also like to do some outdoorsy sort of things. What are your other hobbies that have nothing to do with the arts?
Drugs. Prostitution.
We have so much in common, Michael.
Right, there you are. You know that day. We see each other in the same joints. I swim quite a bit. I'm a runner. I like hiking. In fact, last year at this time, I was hiking through the Himalayas in northern India.
Wow.
And having a wonderful time. I'm a great traveler. I'll jump on a plane at any excuse to go anywhere in the world. In fact, I'm just planning a trip next year to Libya.
Why Libya?
Well, it's a country that has some spectacular Roman ruins that I want to see, and it's just been sort of open for tourism now that it's our ally in the war against terror,
uh-huh.
And it's off the State Department's don't-go-to list.
Huh.
So I'd like to get there before it becomes completely a tourist destination, which it one day will become, because the ruins on the Mediterranean coast are really spectacular. And I've always had an amateur historian's interest in ancient Rome and ancient cities. So I'd like to go travel and to that part of the world and take a look at some of those cities like Leptis Magna, which I'm sure you would like to discuss in more detail with me, as you want to discuss the Franco-Prussian War.
Oh, absolutely. You are Leptis Magna allowed.
Dave Lefkowitz's Leptis Magna Hour.
Hey, look, if PBS would do it, I do it.
You do it. There you are.
And if your plane goes down, my resume's on its way. You know what I'm saying?
I know you're a little vulture, Dave.
Thank you. But you are a big vulture, Michael Riegel. Thank you for swooping into the Daverhood on this show.
Daverhood. Oh, my God.
Hey, we all have our little... we haven't come up with a nickname for you yet.
No, well, you work on it, and you float a few by me, and I'll pick the one I like the best.
A-hole? No, I...
Let's try to keep the conversation on a little more elevated level, shall we, Dave?
And really, you can tell, folks, beneath it all, he's actually a pretty cool guy. Michael Riegel, you can read Riegel, okay, I'm a little tired, couldn't get that straight, in the New York Post on
Wednesdays
and Fridays. His column is there, and catch Theater Talk on PBS early Saturday morning, 12:30 in the morning, and also on CUNY TV, is it?
Yes, CUNY Television. CUNY Television. City University of New York.
Right. Thank you, Michael.
Pleasure. Good luck with your radio show, Dave.
Thank you.